tough stance on asylum seekers. An estimated 70,000 people destined for the U.S. have encountered with similar fates over the past 4 years. The brutal family separation was the darkest part of the Trump era, as authorities are still unable to track down parents of hundreds of kids. The treatment of immigrants by the U.S. highlights its double standards on human rights. The issue Washington often uses as a pretext to impose sanctions on others. But the real question is, what is the root cause of the migrant crisis? Isn't the West, especially the United States, the main culprit for its wars and the subsequent influx of refugees in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a live example that was left in a mess by the U.S. and its allies after almost 2 decades of military presence. People had no choice but to flee the country after the Taliban takeover in mid-August. The number of immigrants has even increased in neighboring Iran, with over 5,000 Afghans reportedly entering the country on a daily basis. The UN has praised Iran, but the sanctions-hit country hasn't received some $136 million in funding the world body said the Islamic Republic needed to support the refugees.
Tens of thousands of workers belonging to South Korea's largest umbrella labor union rallied on the streets of downtown Seoul, defying a city government ban on their gathering.
The current infringement of basic rights by the government under the name of coronavirus prevention is a blindly criminal act which destroys the Constitution.
At the rally location in 1970, 22-year-old Chun Tae-il burned himself to death to protest against the terrible working conditions he endured. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit those in the service sector particularly hard, with layoffs and reductions in hours.
This year especially, many casual workers have suffered because of the coronavirus. They've lost their jobs and had their income reduced due to unpaid leave. We are holding this rally to stop this irrationality.
Demonstrators also protested the gap between regular and irregular workers and a growing disparity between haves and have-nots. South Korean truckers and railway workers have been threatening walkouts recently, with Hyundai union workers voting to strike Friday. South Koreans will be heading to the polls in about 5 months to elect a new president of the country. The main candidates have been decided. And now political forces, like the unionists here today, have begun to battle to see their interests top the campaign agenda. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a fresh air strike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeida province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeida Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbrokered agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeida, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeida, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces. Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldens Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a two-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is a UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-1 6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The birth of the Holy Prophet, the beginning of a new era in human life. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
The responsibility that God placed on his shoulders, Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, is just as great. Because of this great responsibility, God says, Allah did confer a great favor on the believers when he sent among them an apostle from among themselves. Quran, Surah 3, verse 164. God conferred a favor on humanity. Such is the greatness of the Holy Prophet. God, the Exalted, revealed the hidden book to the holy heart of the Holy Prophet, uttered it through his pure tongue, entrusted him with the plan for humanity's felicity in its entirety, and commissioned him to carry out this plan and to demand that his followers carry it out as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The duty of the believers towards the Holy Prophet in every era. Well, we are the followers of the Holy Prophet. We associate ourselves with the Holy Prophet. What is our duty? In every era, the duty of the believers is to see what position they are in, what religion asks of them, what duty has been entrusted to them, what things they should think about, and what they should do. They should understand these in every era. Well, religious scholars and intellectuals have discussed these issues at great length. I will discuss a few points in this regard. One point is about the Islamic nation, and another is about Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The first duty of the Islamic nation at the current time, acting in accordance with Islam's all-inclusiveness. Regarding the issue related to the Islamic nation and the Muslims in general, two points should receive our attention. One is the issue of acting in accordance with the all-inclusiveness of Islam. Another issue is the issue of Muslims' unity.
Allah. The limelight.
President Biden took office pledging to rescind the Trump administration's deliberately harsh policies towards migrants who show up at America's doorstep. But as Joe Biden's first year in office draws to a close, his administration continues to lean heavily on one of those policies. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "It's Time to End the Pandemic Emergency at the Border." The administration says that Border Patrol agents are simply following orders from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, that were put in place to keep the country safe from COVID-19. But there is little doubt that the administration has used the policy as a stopgap measure to quickly remove migrants who are gathering at the southern border in large numbers. Pushed by the economic fallout from COVID in South and Central America, and pulled by rumors of lenient treatment under a more welcoming American president, among other factors. On Friday, 12th of November, congressional investigators released excerpts from testimony by a former senior CDC official who admitted that there was little public health rationale for instituting the policy since the coronavirus was already spreading in the United States by the time the Title 42 order was signed. Border control agents have had close to 2 million encounters with migrants at the border so far in 2021, nearly twice as many as in 2019, and almost four times as many as in 2018. More than a million of this year's encounters ended with migrants being deported or turned away under Title 42. Although the Biden administration has carved out some humanitarian exceptions to Title 42, unaccompanied children, for instance, its continued defense of the policy has horrified activists, international agencies, and even some officials serving within the Biden administration. Two left their posts in recent months after making scathing critiques. That's because the use of Title 42 essentially makes it impossible for migrants who fear for their lives to claim asylum, even at ports of entry, and returns many to squalid camps in Mexico, where they are vulnerable to violence and threats from smugglers and cartels. Under U.S. law, anyone who sets foot on American soil is entitled to express a fear of violence and persecution in their home country, setting off a process that can take years to resolve in backlogged courts. Title 42 effectively short-circuits that process and allows for immediate removal. Meanwhile, many people in the Department of Homeland Security are frustrated that a large number of migrants who are caught sneaking across the border are simply sent back to Mexico, where they regroup and try their luck in another day. Both the Trump administration and the Biden administration used Title 42 to quickly expel unlawful border crossers instead of arresting and prosecuting them. Under the policy, there's little cost to trying to sneak across again and again. As many as half of single adults expelled under Title 42 try to cross the border unlawfully again. That's one reason the number of encounters has been so high this year. Still, many border agents consider Title 42 a powerful tool to control the unusually high number of people trying to cross the border unlawfully, and they're not eager to relinquish it. The result has been the worst of both worlds. The Biden administration finds itself under fire from both the left and the right for its handling of migrants at America's border with Mexico. The chorus of criticism reached new heights in September when images surfaced of more than 10,000 Haitians camping under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, and getting chased by Border Patrol agents on horseback. Opinion polls suggest that the Biden administration is particularly mistrusted on immigration, with one showing that 34% of Democrats and 73% of independents disapprove of how the southern border has been handled. What is broken at the border didn't break in the past few months. It has been broken for years. It will take time and help from Congress to fix it. But the Biden administration must work harder to turn a system that is too often chaotic, arbitrary, and even deadly into one that is more orderly and fair. The American people want a secure border where people enter lawfully, where criminals are arrested, and where people who are in genuine fear for their lives are afforded a chance to apply for political asylum. Some say that Title 42 bought the administration time to rebuild the infrastructure for processing migrants that was dismantled under the former Trump administration. But Title 42 must end, not only because it is morally and legally questionable, but also because the COVID-19 pandemic is receding. As the border opens up to vaccinated tourists, and as it becomes possible to test and vaccinate migrants at ports of entry, the rationale for its use is evaporating. A federal judge ordered an end to the use of Title 42 as applied to family units in September, but the Biden administration appealed that decision. It is time to put a more permanent policy in place. The Biden administration has taken some important steps in that direction. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, the first immigrant to hold the post, is seeking to utilize asylum officers who can adjudicate claims more efficiently than judges. This change, which is based on a plan developed by the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, should help whittle down the enormous backlog of cases. The Biden administration has also opened important discussions with partners in Latin America to develop a regional strategy towards mass migration. While it needs to play a part, the United States is not the only possible destination for refugees. Other countries have played a crucial role in providing opportunities for those escaping hardship, natural disaster, and violence. Colombia, for example, has extended temporary legal status to more than 1 million Venezuelans who were fleeing economic collapse, a commendable policy that allows them to work legally. Brazil, for example, gave work permits to about 98,000 Haitians after the earthquake in Haiti. And Chile has granted permanent residence to about 70,000 Haitians. But the economic fallout from the pandemic made the lives of Haitians in those countries even more precarious and prompted a backlash against them. President Sebastián Piñera of Chile tightened border controls and visa rules and cracked down on illegal immigration in Chile. That caused many to uproot their lives and travel north towards the border with Texas, where Haitians and Venezuelans are showing up in unprecedented numbers. Many of the Haitians who camped out under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas in September had built lives in South America before making the journey to the U.S. border with Mexico. Under U.S. law, people who are already firmly resettled in another country are not eligible for political asylum. But immigration lawyers say a temporary work permit with no path to permanent legal residency in Chile and Brazil should not disqualify Haitians from seeking a permanent safe haven in the United States. Nonetheless, roughly 8,500 Haitians who arrived at the Texas border have been deported to Port-au-Prince in Haiti, a city that is already struggling with fuel shortages, widespread violence, and a political crisis. It will be far more humane to send them back to Chile or to Brazil. American officials should offer more financial and logistical support, as well as more COVID-19 vaccines to countries that agree to resettle migrants. Mass migration, like the pandemic and climate change, can only be addressed by working collaboratively with our neighbors. Lastly, expanding legal pathways for migrants to apply from their own countries for permission to work seasonally or live in the United States could give people hope that if they wait their turn, they will be rewarded. That could help stem the tide of migrants making the dangerous trek north.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's called the Belarus-Poland migrant crisis, and the EU is faulting Belarus for it. It has decided to widen Belarus sanctions as the row intensifies. But is the EU hyping the crisis against Belarus due to its disagreements with the contested presidential election, which saw Lukashenko regain his presidency? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this migrant crisis has its roots at military action that EU countries, along with the U.S., have taken in different parts of the world, especially in West Asia. First, let's get the latest on this. Jerome Hughes is a correspondent joining us from Brussels. Jerome, welcome. So what is the latest that we have on this? We know that the sanctions were extended by the EU. Tell us about that and, of course, the reaction coming from Belarus, if there was any at this point.
That's right, Kaveh. Well, the situation seems to be escalating. There's no doubt about that. I've just been reading an article in one of the so-called mainstream media outlets, the New York Times, and it talks about the fact that the EU has spent billions of euros. This is something we've been saying on Press TV for many years now. The EU is sending billions of euro to countries, say, for example, in Africa, most notably Libya, and also outside of Africa, say, Turkey, to prevent refugees from coming here. So what we're hearing is there, you know, the analysts I've been speaking to, they say this smacks of hypocrisy, that we have a situation whereby the EU is criticizing Belarus, but at the same time, you know, look at aid agencies like Oxfam, they describe it as Fortress Europe, in other words, Fortress EU. The EU is doing all in its power to prevent refugees from coming here. And whether you describe this, you know, as morally reprehensible or, you know, the ethics are all wrong, actually, under international law, the EU has an obligation because rich countries have to take in those seeking asylum. But the EU has a policy of pushing back, repelling refugees. You see 15,000 troops in Poland who are trying to prevent refugees from coming here. And so there is a lot of hypocrisy. And also, you know, it has to be pointed out that we have a situation whereby the government in Minsk, let's face it, is friendly with the government in Moscow. And you have this constant provocation. You talked about sanctions, more sanctions on Belarus. And look at what the EU lawmakers have been saying during the debates last week in the European Parliament. Many of them, not the majority, but a sizable number, have been saying that sanctions don't work. Look at the situation in Moscow, in Russia. Look at the situation in Iran, South African countries, South American countries, I should say, and African countries. Sanctions don't work. It hasn't pushed back Iran. It hasn't pushed back Russia. These countries are thriving in their own way. They have other allies in other parts of the world, like China. And so these sanctions against Belarus, certainly, according to the people I've been speaking to, the EU lawmakers, the analysts, they won't work either. You know, constantly we hear Joseph Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, he talks about Moscow or Russia having the same size economy as California. And it's this constant, apart from the sanctions, it's this constant putting down these world powers, and it doesn't seem to work. Russia put the first man in space until Elon Musk came along. Russia, the only way the United States could get to the International Space Station was using Russian rockets. Two-thirds of the energy being used in the EU comes from Russia, and most of it passes through Belarus. So to try and belittle Russia, and, you know, you could say its friendly neighbor Belarus, and putting these sanctions, the reality is they just don't seem to work.
Thank you for that. We appreciate that. That's Jerome Hughes from Brussels with the latest on that. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from London. Also joining us is senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, who joins us from Budapest.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And George Samioli, I'm going to start with you. Quickly, if you can, give us the short version of what you see as transpiring there on the Poland-Belarus border, how you view this migrant crisis, and whether it's being politicized.
Well, unfortunately, it is indeed being politicized. I mean, the European Union is playing quite a slimy game here. I mean, they really don't care too much about these migrants who are already now freezing in this icy winter temperatures. They want to score political points against Belarus, and of course they're trying to blame Russia for this, and Russia of course has nothing whatever to do with it. Look, as I think your correspondent pointed out, the EU has had these problems before. Erdogan in Turkey has something like 3-4 million refugees that he repeatedly threatens to unleash on the EU, and Germany regularly pays him off in order to stop him doing so. There are migrants who are, that are coming from North Africa, you know, in their, when they're in the Mediterranean, they're shipped off to Italy. We have migrants crossing the English Channel. Again, you know, whenever they're apprehended on the English Channel, the British ship them to safety. So what's so special about this case? Why is it that the EU is unable to do anything at all to help? Well, what's so special is they're coming from Belarus, and he wants to score points against Belarus. There's a very simple solution to this, which is pick up a phone, call Lukashenko, and ask him what is his price. I'm pretty sure his price is a lot lower than Erdogan's price. Belarus is a tiny country compared to Turkey, and all he probably wants is sanctions being lifted off Minsk. But the EU, for ideological reasons, isn't prepared to pay that price.
What was Turkey's price, by the way? Do you know?
I think it's something like 3-4 billion euros.
Okay, so Marcus Papadopoulos, let me review with you this EU accusation and see what you think, where the EU has accused Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, orchestrating the influx of migrants to pressure it to back down over sanctions slapped on the government. Now, Belarus has dismissed that as being absurd. How do you view it?
The tension on the Polish-Belarusian border is not in itself about migrants. After all, America, Britain, the European Union and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants to enter Europe as a result of Britain, America, NATO and the EU having destabilized both Libya and Syria through having supported terrorists in both countries. No. What we see at the Polish-Belarusian border is geostrategic politics in action, and specifically Russia is the target. Firstly, America and Britain do not wish the union state of Russia and Belarus, let us remember Belarus is the historical name of Belarus, they do not want the union state of Russia and Belarus to materialize, whereby Belarus will reunify with Russia. Why? Because in the event of the Union state of Russia and Belarus coming into being, Russian national security in Eastern Europe will receive a tremendous boost. Secondly, America and Britain are trying to foment civil unrest in Belarus in the hope that this will assist them in their quest to initiate a coup in Belarus aimed to bring down President Alexander Lukashenko, to wrestle Belarus out of Moscow's orbit and into the West's sphere of influence. And thirdly, NATO, which of course is directed by Washington and London, is looking for a pretext to increase NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic, and of course in the Black Sea region, which of course is an anti-Russia motivation. And as a result of the last few days, what we now see is NATO having its pretext to go ahead in increasing its soldiery and weaponry along the Russian border. As I said at the beginning, this situation on the Polish-Belarusian border has nothing to do with migrants. After all, there are only a few thousand migrants at the Belarusian, the Polish-Belarusian border, and yet the Americans, the British, the EU, and NATO had no qualms about allowing well over 1 million migrants into Europe a few years ago.
Right. Well, let's see here. First of all, George Samioli, do you agree with the assessment there made and the analysis there made by Marcus Papadopoulos?
I do. I think that there is clearly a strategic agenda here. It's been of long standing, which is to topple the government of Lukashenko in Belarus and thereby weaken Russia substantially. Let's keep in mind that the regime change that the Western powers engineered in Ukraine in February of 2014 was a strategic blow to Russia. There's no question. I mean, that having bad relations with a country that is basically kind of a brother nation that is Ukraine was a huge blow to Russia, and losing Belarus would indeed be something that would be strategically catastrophic. And that is why I believe that that the EU and the United Kingdom and NATO want to continue to aggravate this crisis at the border and make this into this giant propaganda exercise in demonizing both Russia and Belarus. I mean, how is Russia in any way involved in this? And yet, if you listen to, or rather read the article written by UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss over the weekend, somehow it is all Russia's fault because Russia was supposed to have leaned on Lukashenko and told him what to do, which kind of undermines the whole idea that, you know, Belarus and Russia are kind of two separate states. So I think that there's no question that that is the agenda. And of course, as Marcus points out, I mean, we're only talking about a few thousand. So it is fascinating to see why this sudden hysteria about a few thousand when, you know, in 2015, you know, a million migrants were absorbed by the EU. And again, why focus there rather than on what's going on, say, in the English Channel? Are they coming from Belarus? Are the migrants that are coming from North Africa and going to Italy, are they coming from Belarus? So you know, this is all a part of the kind of you know, engineering this hostile alliance against Russia.
Okay, so we have what has been described by you, Marcus Papadopoulos, which the main target appears to be Russia, as you said. But looking at Moscow's reaction is a bit of an eye-opener, because from what we understand, Moscow sent nuclear-capable bombers to patrol the Belarusian skies and nations bordering Belarus. As a result, have voiced alarm because of that. How do you view Russia's reaction militarily here in terms of sending these bombers?
Belarus and the Russian Federation, on paper, are two separate countries. The truth of the matter, however, is that Belarus is de facto a part of the Russian Federation. The Belarusian armed forces are de facto a part of the Western Military District of the Russian Federation. However, whilst the chances of a Western coup succeeding in Belarus are negligible, Russia cannot take any chances whatsoever. That is why Russia has learned from its mistakes it made regarding Ukraine at the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014, when the Kremlin was very, very slow to react to what was clearly a Western orchestrated coup in the making. So in regard to Belarus, that is why the Kremlin has dispatched nuclear bombers to safeguard the borders of Belarus and effectively the borders of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. That is also why the Kremlin has dispatched Russian paratroopers to safeguard the border of Belarus, which of course is also the border of the Union State of Russia and Belarus. In hypothetically speaking, if a Western coup was to succeed in Belarus and Belarus was to be brought into the West's sphere of influence, that would be a catastrophic setback for Russian national security, because what it would mean is that the entire frontier of the Russian Federation in the West, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, would be enclosed with countries which are in the West's sphere of influence. And we know already that Britain has sent soldiers to Poland to officially speaking, advise the Polish government on how to secure its border. My own personal view is those British soldiers should actually be in Dover, actually safeguarding Britain's border against illegal migration across the English Channel. And also, the British have said that they have 600 paratroopers and SAS soldiers ready to go to Poland if the situation deteriorates on the Belarusian-Polish border.
Okay.
So that is why Russia is taking the situation so very seriously. But also Russia is compelled to because of the union state of Russia and Belarus, which, I should add, will materialize sooner rather than later.
Okay. Well, we do need to talk about the humanitarian aspect of this, George Zamiali, and the hypocrisy that's involved. At the top of the broadcast of the program, we had our correspondent talk about how what EU says and does is hypocritical because it spends billions to stop these refugees from coming to the EU countries, even though as a rich nation they need to take in some refugees. We can have your reaction on that issue, and also how, for example, the U.S. Stops migrants crossing the border from, for example, Mexico, never mind the harsh treatment that these migrants receive. So are we sensing here a sense of hypocrisy from the EU and the U.S. also?
Well, yes. It is kind of interesting that, the accusations against Belarus, that, Belarus is to blame for the migrant flow. Well, no one in the United States would ever, at least any respectable person in the United States would try to do that in Mexico. They say, well, if Mexico is to blame for the migrant flow that's quite substantial into the United States. But in terms of the humanitarianism, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have these migrants now sleeping out in the cold. This is now getting, it's middle of November. It is very, very cold. And why is this happening? Well, it's happening because the EU, NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States want to use this as a massive propaganda campaign against Russia and Belarus, and therefore to show, hey, these are the people we're up against. So we've got a democracy summit that's scheduled for December the 9th and December the 10th, so it's in about 3 weeks' time. And, what's going to be on the agenda? Well, the agenda will be the terrible people such as Russia and Belarus, or because Iran will be included in that. But that is part of the ideological mobilization that NATO is continuing to engage in. So they really don't care about the plight of these migrants. I think they're quite happy to have this on the news every night. And then they point to, hey, well, who's to blame? Well, it's these terrible people, Putin and Lukashenko. And, and this is being done, stated explicitly by Western officials, as I say, by the UK Foreign Secretary, who's now, going around mouthing this nonsense day after day.
So let's try to figure out through you, Marcus Papadopoulos, what is going to happen in this situation. One aspect of it, which was interesting, was the fact that the Belarusian President Lukashenko threatened to cut off gas supplies to Europe, and Putin said that he did not approve of that, in so many words. And he said that, I think, he said perhaps Lukashenko said that in a fit of anger. Do you see something like that transpiring? I mean, at this point, the EU has leveled sanctions. It may even go further. How do you see it?
No, I do not see gas supplies being cut off whatsoever. After all, as I said moments ago, Belarus is de facto a part of the Russian Federation, and under no circumstances will the Kremlin allow anything to disrupt the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe. Why? Because in a scenario where the flow of natural gas, Russian natural gas to Europe is disrupted, the Russian economy would suffer immensely, and would suffer immensely overnight. And let us not forget that the West's sanctions on Russia which have been in force for coming up to 8 years now are very severe. And one of the ways that Russia has managed to mitigate the losses it's sustained is by increasing the flow of Russian natural gas to Europe, but also to China. So undoubtedly, Lukashenko made that comment either in a fit of rage or to provoke the West, but under no circumstances will the Russian natural gas be disrupted in its flow to Europe. No. What we will see is, as a result of the tension on the Polish-Belarusian border, we will see NATO's presence increase in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic and in the Black Sea, and consequently we will see Russia and Belarus's initiative to initiate the reunification of the two countries come into play sooner rather than later.
Okay.
And the West has actually inadvertently sped up the integration between Belarus and Russia, because Moscow and Minsk clearly understand there is a very serious threat posed to Belarus by NATO and the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Russia will safeguard its security on its western border and in fact increase enormously its security on its western border is by ensuring that Russia and Belarus reunify. And as I keep on saying, that will happen sooner rather than later.
Do you think that a reunification is going to be the outcome here, George Samueli? Is it even required, given the fact that we know Russia does support Belarus in the form and fashion that it has?
Well, that's it. I think that the unification has been an ongoing thing, and de facto they are one country, particularly as Belarus is clearly under threat, and the only thing that saves Belarus is that it's that Russia has its back. I mean, you know, obviously there are lots of issues that need to be ironed out before they can become one state, but de facto it is one state, and that's, and therefore anyone who tries anything with Belarus knows that they have Russia to deal with. And Russia has made this very clear, that in any attempt at staging a coup in Minsk will be met with force from Moscow. So, yeah, de facto, it is essentially already one state.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos from London. Thank you for your comments. And senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, spoke to us from Budapest, and we had our correspondent Jerome Hughes spoke to us from Brussels. And that